We're back this week on My Stoop with Ray. One of the things I always wanted to talk about on My Stoop is the importance of preservation within our community. Being able to keep our heritage in some way while moving forward economically. It is an issue that's affected our neighborhood, Upper Fowles Point and Fowles Point, Baltimore in general, but it's also an issue that's affecting communities all around this country, and indeed globally. One thing I like to talk about is the difference between a historical event where you have, let's say, a property or a location where you have battles, historic battles. This is an easy example of why we want to keep that location and make it a park where people could come. But lots of times when the preservationists are speaking, they talk about keeping our historic Main Street, preserving our heritage where we grew up and where our forefathers grew up, where Johnny went to get a haircut, where people ate at the local diner, the heart and soul of the community, where people went and watched movies. It is a big movement in this country, and many neighborhoods are struggling with this. Related to our neighborhood in Fowles Point, we're in Upper Fowles Point, but our neighbor directly besides that is Fowles Point, a lovely neighborhood along the water, of very historic character. It's where the boats were made, our skipjacks, a lot of our war boats and machines. It's an area where merchants and marines and people of all types of characters met and grew. It was a place of history. The year was back in 1967. The legislature and the powers that be at that time wanted to put the 95 Beltway through this neighborhood. At the time, it still preserved its character, but now it's of a little different nature. But let's go back to 1967. The neighbors felt that it was in their interest as citizens of the U.S. to preserve their neighborhood. They gathered, they fought, and they won. We had leaders like Barbara Mikulski, a great senator, and also born at that time was the historic Fowles Point, the Federal Hill and Fowles Point Preservation Society. From that year on, these neighbors worked to preserve and restore our heritage. It is something, a lesson, that we should all learn. Here to talk to us today is the president of this society, and also she manages the Fowles Point Visitor Center in association with her many activities. We also want to talk to her today about history, because she knows everything about history around here. And as I always said, history is such an important point. Ellen Von...
Carrion.
Okay, I was going to ask you that. Around here, folks, we don't really know each other by our last names. We know each other by our first names or our street designations. So I know Ellen as Ellen. And I wanted to ask you, were you involved back in those days?
I was not involved back in 1967.
Okay.
I did, however, follow the, well, it was a long and arduous course, and I did follow the, and I knew names like Bob Eaney, and of course I knew Lou Fisher.
Right.
Who were key figures in it. And from time to time, there would be articles in the newspaper. So I always followed it.
Right.
Because I love the built environment and I love history. But I was not personally involved at that time.
I mean, this had to be huge news subjects in the Sun and the Evening Post. I mean, I imagine it sparked a lot of people's interest in the area, you know.
Well, I think one of the things about the so-called road fight, it went on for years and years and years.
Right. Wow. I did not know that.
You had the, I mean, you know, you had a city government, you had a state government, and you had a federal highway system that did want to put this extension of 95 right through Fells Point, Federal Hill, and Montgomery Street. Mm-hmm. And there were any number, just as there are now when issues come up, there were any number of community meetings. Fells Point.
I'm sure, dozens.
Dozens, hundreds.
Wow.
Hundreds over a 10-year period, really. And, of course, why all of the government entities were interested in this, at least at the state and city level, was that any time that you have a highway coming through, it means lots of dollars flowing into the local economy. And at that point in time, let's say the first time it was introduced in the city council, everyone, Barbara Mikulski then was on the Baltimore City Council.
And oh, was she?
She was. And Barbara voted in favor of the highway just because it meant money and jobs. There was one person.
Wow, okay.
One person who opposed it. He's still alive. He's very active with the Irish Shrine, with the houses over on the west side, mm-hmm. Lemon Street, the Irish Railroad workers' houses. And that is Judge Tom Ward. Tom Ward was the one member of the city council who actually said, we got to think about the incredible history of this community. So there's always that balance. There's always that balance between the economic gain that can be realized from anything, whether it's a highway or a development program of any type, and then the history and the heritage of the place. And the artful players, the ones who do these things well, find the golden mean. They find that balance between.
Yes.
And if they don't find the balance, then you begin to have the kinds of problems that, you know, you get not enough parking, or you get too many traffic jams, or, you know,
right.
You have to find the right balance between things. And I think finding that balance is a long and arduous process. And it was here in Fells Point. The other thing, the Fells Point of the day, if you went back and looked at what Fells Point was like in the 50s and the 60s, and we look at some of the old photographs, we look at, there was a CD that was made where they just went and interviewed a great many people in Fells Point, and what you see is a neighborhood that was very, if you will, run down.
Yes.
It was, Federal Hill was the same way.
It was a diamond in the rough.
It was a diamond in the rough, but unless you had the eyes to see the diamond, it just looked like the rough. The other thing is, I mean, Fells Point, from some of the things that I've read, it had been a sort of sailor's town. It was considered, well, let me just put it this way, it was the last place in the city that got public sanitation in the 1930s. So we were not in the high tax brackets where we necessarily had a big and strong voice in city government or state government. We were the people. I mean, we were the ordinary people. And that's what Fells Point was. It was from the very beginning, it was a colonial working man's community. We didn't have a Thomas Jefferson coming out of Fells Point. We didn't have a Charles Carroll coming out of Fells Point. We had ordinary men and ordinary women leading pretty extraordinary lives in terms of what they were doing for the nation and for the founding of the city and the state. But we were ordinary people, so we didn't have a big voice. So they thought, okay, we've got these areas. What the heck? These people aren't going to care. These people won't mind. So let's just... This would be the least impacted. Plus, it's down. It's all industrial around there. I'm sure all of these thoughts went through.
No, I understand, and it seems like, and it sounds like, so many of the other situations we've been involved in Baltimore, where we've struggled with the same issues. For instance, with the hotel, the big hotel that, you know, the Waterfront Coalition fought.
You're talking about the Marriott.
Hotel.
Inner Harbor Marriott.
Inner Harbor East.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Issues like that. We had our own situation, the North Shore, in our own neighborhood, you know, where everybody just assumed, they'll just build whatever you want. And actually, that was, you know, that's a valuable piece of property to us because it represents the heart and soul of the community. But it was a diamond in the rough. And this is the issue that I think so many of our communities are facing. So anyway, let's move on to... Let's move on to the history of the area in general. I mean, it's a fascinating history.
It is. I guess one of the first people who took a look at Fells Point was Captain John Smith. That's Captain John Smith, the same John Smith whose name is inextricably linked with Pocahontas. Mm. But when John Smith was on his voyage of discovery, he came sailing up the Chesapeake, came sailing up the Patapsco River, and he saw this area, and he recorded in his log that it was so heavily wooded that he felt that it would be not a priority area for settlement, and so there was no instant colony that came.
I never knew that story.
Yes, well, he in fact did. So that sort of stalled things for a bit of time. The Fell family showed up a bit later on and really created the first settlement here. Now, everyone, I think, has in their head, because of the shipbuilding history that we have here, that the very first thing that Fells Point ever was a huge shipbuilding community. But in fact, in the beginning, it was not. It was a settlement. It was a huge estate. There was timber here. There were farms here. And Fell really had, it wasn't a ship. It was not, it didn't begin as a shipbuilding center. It began just as a gentleman's country estate that he worked very hard in order to support his family. He had a brother who was a merchant, who started a business down in Jonestown. The Fells were Quakers.
Interesting. Okay.
And people, and you know, the Fell family, and you know, Quakers, they were somewhat restricted in terms of the kinds of occupations that they could enter because of their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
They were not... for one thing, and I think everybody knows this about the Quakers, but they were not, by their religious beliefs, to bear arms, which meant that they were not to engage in any kind of military efforts. They were not to hold slaves. They were one of the very first groups from the very beginning when George Fox founded the Quaker religion. They felt that this was a fundamental violation of human rights. So any of the professions, and particularly in those days before we had any kind of power equipment, I mean, the entire farming economy depended upon, in most places, upon slave labor.
Okay, first of all, so it sounds like the area was a bastion of freedom for and religion tolerance, which I find to be what happened, you know, with the creation of the state of Maryland, you know, which was Catholic, but they allowed Protestantism. And now you're telling me Quakers were involved in this formula.
Well, at least in the founding of Fells Point.
Okay.
And the, yes, I mean,
it creates tradition. I mean, you know.
There was that tradition. However, you know, and certainly Maryland was founded as the free state, and certainly it was the Ark and the Dove down in St. Mary's County. And but that sort of passed by because there's always been that religious undertone to things. And the Protestants soon saw that there were certain restrictions placed on things. But the reason I'm talking about the Fell family is that they were restricted from certain kinds of activities. So they created this, and then another member of the family came, and they did begin. They did begin the shipyard. Now, we had hardly any population at all here, really, until about the time of the American Revolution. And the American Revolution changed everything for Fells Point, because we became a major center for logistics and for supplies. You have to remember that the British occupied Philadelphia, they occupied Boston, they occupied New York, and they did not occupy Baltimore. And I'm sure scholars would have a better answer than I. There was one British ship that started up the Chesapeake, but it floundered on shoals there, because the Chesapeake has a great many shoals in it, and it can be difficult to navigate. You have to remember these British ships were very large ships. So it floundered there, and that was the last attempt that they made. I've heard lots of theories about why they didn't. One was that a great deal of tobacco was shipped out of here. And after all, people do like their tobacco. And I guess if they closed the port of Fells Point, they might not know where they'd get their... give a great deal of credence to it, but...
The first, the chop tank, on the front of the top chop tank, is where they first introduced tobacco in Maryland. So, yeah, tobacco, and then Jamestown started making its money off of tobacco. So that makes sense to me.
And, of course, we had tobacco as a major crop along with wheat on all of on the shores all the way down the Chesapeake from very, very, very early on in the settlement here.
Yes.
So the other possible reason was that the British just didn't see this as particularly strategic. I mean, Baltimore was not as large as New York. It wasn't as large or as affluent as Philadelphia. I mean, we were just barely on the map. The streets here, I mean, we hadn't paved the streets. I mean, we hadn't done anything. But suddenly, there was a need to fight the mightiest army and the mightiest navy on the face of the earth, you know, the British Lion.
Wow.
And we weren't even yet the United States of America. We were a group of colonies that had taken in the Revolutionary War, but had taken on this great power, and we didn't have an army, we didn't have a navy, we really had only our intention of freedom because of the policies that the British had imposed upon us. Mm-hmm. So what mm-hmm. happened here was, and it happened again on a much larger scale in the War of 1812, but you suddenly had many, many ships being built here. You had every kind of ship being drafted into service in one way or another. And you had this big population explosion where you had many people moving in. You needed housing for many people.
This is during the Revolutionary War.
During the period of the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
And you had all of the associated, I'll call them businesses, showing up. I mean, you had your merchants, but you also, you had to have a place to feed people. So you had
right.
to have the bar, you had to have your taverns.
Right,
and you had
absolutely.
To have a baker, and you had to have a doctor, and you had to have all of these various services. So all of a sudden, Fells Point really came to have more of a population, really came to attract a wide array of people, but a lot of basic working class people. And you had us playing a really significant unsung role in that
right.
war, because we were the one
okay.
place. And
yes,
you have to remember as well, if you think of the stories of George Washington and the winter that he spent with his men at Valley Forge, they didn't have boots. They didn't have food. They came close to starving to death. I mean, this was another one of those grassroots efforts that just took the most amazing amount of fortitude. When I look back, when I read yeah. the history of this, it seems to me a miracle that we ever actually did achieve our freedom from the British, but we did.
Right, very good.
And Fells Point
sure.
was the breadbasket. Fells Point, well, other things. I mean, George, the states were George Washington, our dear friend and the father of our nation. He was to have, if you enrolled in the militia, if you joined the militia, mm-hmm. you had to leave your livelihood, you had to leave your wife, you had to leave your children. Most people, it was an agrarian economy then, for most people were employed in that. So you had to leave how you were going to feed your family as well. So the expectation was that you would be paid wages. Well, the states were supposed to provide the wages. There was no federal government, of course. There was no United States yet. Well, the states just, they enjoyed being defended by the militia, but they didn't really come up with any money.
So, right, sure.
So you had this horrible economy going on all over the place, and I guess Fells Point was a little bit less affected, but times were tough. You had many people here going bankrupt. You had people like Robert Long, the merchant. We owned his house. So it was an interesting time.
Okay, so I mean, and that kind of led to the next phase in our lifetime. All right, I guess we got that rogue or miscreant rep where we, you know, privateers.
And the privateers, anybody who was in the merchant business, outfitted their vessel with cannons. And what privateering, and it isn't really miscreant. I mean, it's something that's been...
Well, a lot of the British saw it that way. I mean, it led to the 1814,
of course.
You know, I mean, 1812.
And yet, if you go back and you recall the story...
We don't think of it that way. We think of them as heroes, right?
Exactly.
I mean, because they were doing it to us. I mean, that was the whole point. You know, they didn't really respect our Navy at the time.
They didn't respect our Navy at the time, although that was less of a conflict then than it got to be as time went
right,
on.
Right, after the Revolutionary War.
But this notion of a letter of marque, which is what authorizes, in time of war, authorizes a private armed vessel to capture enemy ships,
okay.
is a long-standing tradition. The British themselves, if you recall, during
yes.
the reign of Queen Elizabeth, you know, they had a major enemy called Spain that was
sure.
coming at them with this armada of enormous proportion. Elizabeth, as wealthy as she was, they didn't have enough naval ships at that point in time. So the British went out, and they enlisted all manner of privateers.
Yeah, it's been on both sides for so many years. I mean, you know, and then one side would complain about it. But, you know, I mean, what? Because everybody was doing it, you know.
And yet the other point is that it's different than piracy. Piracy simply has, no binding legislation. A privateer has to post a bond. You have to go in and lay down $5, $10, whatever $1,000, which was a huge amount of money.
There were merchants back then. There were leaders of the community who put that stuff together.
They were risk takers. They were from a certain point of view. I mean, venture capitalist is the wrong word, but these men were major speculators. They were relying on the particular design of the vessels that were made in Fells Point, and they were relying on the enormous talent of our sea captains and their crews. They relied on that totally. And, of course, privateering might or might not be a profitable venture. I mean, when it was first organized, they had the privateers paying a percentage of whatever they took in, typical taxation strategy, you know, back to the government. They had to eliminate that as they went along because it wasn't in any way, shape, or form worth risking a ship, a crew. The other thing is we have a large population today. Back in those days, I mean, every skilled man and woman mattered because, you know, we had a very high mortality rate. We had people didn't live to be very old. I mean, every skilled person mattered deeply back in those days. And
there's some Shanghaiing going on, though, right? In the bars? Wasn't there some Shanghaiing here and there? I mean, was that later? I mean, or was that sometime between the gangs of Baltimore?
I think any time when you have a port city.
Yes.
Any time that you have a port city. And any time that, and let's face it, I mean, life at sea is a very demanding and difficult life.
Yes.
So from time to time, you have men who that they might have become ill. They might, for any number of reasons, just the captain was short of a crew. So from time to time, yes, the history of Shanghaiing factors in a major way in Fells Point as it does in all port cities.
Sure. No, not to make bad of it. We just want to, you know, explore it. And there, you know, when we talked about that, one of the first things we talked about when we first met each other was, you know, I said, well, the neighborhood was saucy, wasn't it? And you said, yeah, you laughed at me.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and so that kind of evolved, I guess, like, you know, related some bordellos, some beautiful buildings around where the old bordellos were.
Indeed.
You know, where the hangings, external hangings, you know, of the houses, you know, are very beautiful, and you know, we accept that side of the thing. And when you're walking around, you feel that sense of history, and you know, you get excited. You know, it's an exciting place to be. Okay, so you gave us a good example of how it was right from the start. You also gave me great examples how the neighborhood was when the folks first gathered back then in 1967, more elegantly than I did at first. Okay. One of the things I told you is I brought this cup along, this coffee cup along, because it was one of the first times I really got to understand. I was a renter at the time in the area, renting a house over on the 400 block of Washington Street. And, you know, I was at the Fells Point Festival, and I saw the stand for the Preservation Society. And my good buddy at the time, Dan Winter, was, you know, sitting there taking a bunch of information. And he, you know, I saw this cup, and you guys are doing some shirts and stuff. And I realized what a great job you guys were doing in the neighborhood restoring these places. There's on one side of the cup is the London Coffee House, circa 1771. And on the other side, it's George Wells' house, circa 1787. And I'm sure you've done a lot of different projects like that, the Preservation Society, to do that, to, you know.
Well, that one was, the London Coffee House was an interesting, it's an interesting story. It is 1771.
Okay.
And that is, in terms of decisions that were made that affected Fells Point history and the history of the city of Baltimore, even the American Revolution.
Yes.
1771, people have heard of Lloyd's of London, and you have to kind of roll your head back to a day when, if you wanted news from overseas, there was no internet, there was no radio, there was no TV. So all the news came in on the ships, and the merchants congregated there. And that's where, and there was insurance then, insurance is as old as privateering or possibly even older.
Okay.
There were always insurers, so people would be posting their bonds there, people would be getting the news there. When it came time to make the decision about when the incorporation of Baltimore City was taking place, they wanted Fells Point to become a part of this new, there was Baltimore Town, there was Jonestown, and there was Fells Point. And Fells Point was a little hesitant to get itself involved in becoming part of this larger unit. And it was intensely debated there.
Right.
They went, people like Mordecai Gist, who was very famous in the...
Really?
I've
heard of him.
Gist, yeah. He went there, and I believe it was... And he just made the decision, and I think it was at the London Coffee House, and wrote the letter I'm not sure who he wrote the letter to, but he wrote a letter from there announcing his intention to raise a regiment, what would become known as the Maryland Line, that would defend, that would really play such a major role in the American Revolution, and particularly in the Battle of Long Island, where everyone probably would have died and where we had very heavy casualties. So all sorts of history took place in the London Coffee House.
The importance of political discourse in places of gathering, you know, mm-hmm. places where people gather along mm-hmm. Main Street.
And that was we still do it today. You go to the coffee house, how many important seeds are sown for new visions of the future? How many deals are cut? It's either happening, and a lot of it happens in the coffee houses, and some of it happens in some of our more civilized taverns and restaurants. It's still, the world hasn't really greatly changed. But the London Coffee House was acquired by Constellation Energy, and they had posted a demolition sign on the back of the property. And one of our residents, Jack Troutwine, PJ, was out walking his dog, Buffy. And as we all know, Fells Point is a place where just about everybody has a dog, but they walk. And Jack's mm-hmm. walking by, and he sees this
everybody
sign.
Knows each other and says hello,
and
too.
Everybody knows each other and says hello. And Jack sees this sign, and he came back, and he called the Preservation Society, and he said, they want to tear down the London Coffee House. It's one of the places where everybody gathered. It's where all the business got done. So what are we going to do? So they set up this phone tray, and they started calling and calling. And in the meantime, the Preservation Society knew they didn't stand a chance unless they could acquire the funds to be able to purchase the property and then rehab it. So with assistance from Preservation Maryland, which is another preservation organization which deals with important properties throughout the state, they made a low-interest loan available. The Maryland Historical Trust made some funds available, and the Preservation Society was able to acquire that property and what we then believed was the George Wells House. However, I wish that I could express to you what the building looked like on the interior and the exterior. It was, as we say, extremely endangered.
Yes.
So sometimes in preservation, I think there's many examples of this, but I guess maybe the most notable is the preservation efforts in Charleston, South Carolina. There's no one organization, private, public, or whatever, that's ever going to have enough money and enough resources to be able to really preserve a community. It has to be a partnership, and you have to involve private citizens, and you have to involve businesses, and you have, so it can't just be the National Trust for Historic Preservation or the Department of Housing and Community Development. It has to be individuals and businesses who are also buying into this whole notion.
Yes, it has to be an assembly of people. I remember when we fought the North Shore issue. I mean, we negotiated. We didn't fight. But, yeah, we did fight. But all the people from, I always remember this, and including the Preservation Society, everybody together, all the neighborhoods, all came to our meetings, at the dozens of meetings, and it was just a conglomeration of groups.
And it,
you know,
it takes, when the, you know, that expression, which I really love, it takes a village. It takes a village.
Right.
I mean, we are, you know, no man is an island, and no enterprise is an island. So what happened with the London Coffee House was, we began to get the estimates for what it was going to cost to restore it. And the Preservation Society is a small organization. We got a grant. We did what you call stabilize it. That means you buttress it up however you can so that it doesn't fall down while you're trying to get your funding and your financing in place.
Right.
But we were not, we looked at it and we said, this is simply, it's so far beyond our means, these two properties. We cannot do it. So we issued a request for a proposal and sent it out into the larger world. And it ended up with the Struver organization purchasing it and later back with another local business that's been here for a very long time, Canusa Paper. And Canusa now has their offices in the in what we referred to then as the George Wells House.
Okay, not to cut you off, but you know, Struver was always known for being able to take historic properties and restore, you know, it, put it to adaptive use, a new adaptive use, and that's what we try to do in this community is find developers with good history of that stuff. Not to, but you know, I'm glad you mentioned Struver, and I'm not sure about this other company, but.
Canusa is not a developer.
Okay.
They're actually a company that deals. They're a green company that deals with recycling, and we're pretty visionary in that area. Frankly, and they're right here. They're right here in Fells Point.
So,
but they've been on the cutting edge, and this was a long time ago.
Okay, so the project was basically a green project then?
It wasn't a green project. I'm just saying that the company that was involved, Canusa is they're not a developer. They have a completely different kind of
business.
They're
moralistic. They're responding to the moral suasion of
Bruce Fleming, who is the person who, the principal at Canusa, has always been a lover of history as well.
He merchants
chose
like that.
His business location to be right in Fells Point. He has been around for years. He was on the board at Preservation Maryland, so he had that kind mentality, kind of going into it. And of course, Bill Struver, I mean, he was simply the best in terms of being, and you can see examples of this all over this city and other cities as well. He had the sensitivity to the environment, and he had simply the ability to be able to rehabilitate and adaptively reuse properties in amazing ways. I mean, I see right. evidence of him, and every time I do, I have to smile. So that's what we did. We turned it over to another entity because it was beyond our means. You have to be realistic about what it is that you can accomplish. What helped us to do that, and what is a tremendous asset in the state of Maryland, is this historic tax credit program that we have. And the Preservation Society played a role in, it's a legislated program. It has to be approved by the General Assembly of the state of Maryland. And years ago now, and it was, of course, it was before my time, but the Preservation yes. Society, along with Preservation Maryland and Baltimore Heritage, went out and secured a grant to see what would the economic impact be on the state of Maryland if we had such a program. And it's an amazing program. It's one of the most liberal of any of the states. Well, I shouldn't use the word liberal, that might create the wrong impression. What it does or what it did in those days was for all of the authorized expenditures, everything that you were doing to
for each project,
to properly do the design work for the building itself, so that the history of the building was preserved, you qualified for 20% a 20% tax credit after you had submitted all of your paperwork. In other words, it was
was the Maryland Historic Trust involved with that?
Yeah, so it's the Maryland Historical Trust manages that program.
They're very helpful to us in the North Shore, by the way.
Yes, and it was available to businesses and to residents in those days. So what this means, and then of course the city came up with a program.
You had to pass an audit, the Maryland Historic Trust audit, right, to get approved for the proposed
project you had to submit all of your drawings and
right.
your designs in advance before you began the work. But then it would assist you if you needed your mortar to be repointed, if you needed structural repairs. You have to remember, many of the properties in Fells Point were really in pretty bad shape by the time this program got into play.
Plus, your area had to be designated as historic district,
you
right?
You had to have your area designated, or your property itself could be individually listed, but you had to have designation as you had to be, quote-unquote, a historic structure. So Fells Point
right.
had that designation from very early on.
Sure.
It was how we were able to save
That happened
Fells
in, what, 69, they gave that historic
yes.
designation?
Yes, it became one of the very first areas in the country to
really?
Be covered under the... to be listed as a historic site on the National Register of Historic Preservation.
Which led to a huge trend. I mean, it took a while, but, now this is a major way in all types of cities to, the historic, getting the designation and all that stuff,
It's a huge trend. Which is good because it shows that more people are interested in the built environment and the history of their neighborhood. It's Baltimore, for a period of time, had more designated historic districts, even, I think, than Boston and New York City. I think we've slipped behind by a couple of, maybe a half dozen or a dozen by now. But
it's a city of firsts.
It's a city of firsts, and for a while there, we outstripped any other city. And there's different kinds of designations. There's the federal designation. There's the local designation, or the CHAP designation.
Right,
and
yes.
And we were a federal register historic district from the late 60s moving forward. But we just became a CHAP district about 8 years ago. And they have slightly different things, slightly different protections, slightly different programs.
Okay.
But just to talk about the economics, Baltimore was fortunate to be in the state of Maryland and to have a city, the city government provided its own tax credit, which in essence took the form of freezing the property value at the unimproved value. If you bought a house for $60,000 and you put $200,000 worth of repairs into it, your tax assessment was still going to be $60,000 for 10 years, unless they just happened to do an incremental tax increase on the whole block. But you did not instantly get taxed for the other $200,000 worth of improvements that you put into your property.
Well, that was probably helpful to be able to cover for all the expenses that people had to undergo to restore one of these properties.
It was and that's my point, that it was extremely helpful. The other thing is that, and the reason that these programs exist and are in the historic preservation agencies is because, well, you know, we're largely a brick community here, but let's say you just said, well, heck, I'm not in a historic district. I'm just going to put, let me just put aluminum siding and cover up this old brick. What these tax programs did was it provided a guideline so that the neighborhood continued to look historic, but it helped to subsidize some of those extra costs that you might have to find that specialist who could do your brick repointing and your brick repair. Other than just to, you know, slap up something that would have been inappropriate.
Okay, not to cut you off.
Oh, go ahead.
Because I don't want to run too long, and some other issues that I'd like to talk about.
But go ahead.
All right. Which actually leads us to, you know, the federal Main Street program that's going on across the country now, where if you're an organization of merchants and you get together. And you can actually, you know, it's not always a history, you know, here we have a lot of history, but one of the points is that it's the history of a community is often underlooked, you know, it's a diamond in the rough and it's Main Street. It's where we were, you know? So I think what this applies to is a lot of our cities and also a lot of our small town Americas, you know, not so much the suburbs, you know, I mean, they are developing their own history, but, you know, this is where we can help, you know, put off the, you know, send a message to everybody else that, you know, this is doable, you know, that, you know, there are these unique programs, for instance, historic districts, tax credits that, you know, has taken off in wildfire, getting developers who are, you know, are conscientious about different uses and, you know, are in tune with that. And also getting through community associations or, you know, through the preservation societies that are set up locally to get projects in there that, you know, are economical and yet take the property and adopt the use while preserving the historic character of a property. Let's talk about where we are now, because even though, you know, we've done so much good work, you know, there's still a lot to be done. And we're talking about some of this, some of these issues earlier. For instance, continuing density issues in our community where we've become so successful that, you know, some of the concerns I've heard about the new proposed project on Allied Chemical, and, you know, we're talking about the other issue over there by the dead end. So,
Union War.
You know, also wooden houses. You guys are doing a great job, and those things are totally threatening the original wooden houses. So let's talk about that a bit, and maybe Billie Holiday, if we could get a chance.
Okay. So, well, if you want to start first with the whole notion of the continuing development of Fells Point, we do have major projects going on throughout this community right now. And in some ways, I look at them and I think, whew, you know, the economy is not that good, but we are in a boom mode.
Yes.
In Fells Point, and really...
That's what happens when you take these things and forget about the old Quiddy Highway, that could go somewhere else. We restored a diamond in the rough. So look at all the great economic benefits.
Right. And when you're, and you know, finally, and everything is cyclical, long cycles, I hope. But, you know, when you're hot, you're hot. When you're not, you're not. So right now, this entire waterfront area is under development. But Southeast Baltimore and going all the way over to 95, going across Boston Street, everywhere you look, you see the tower cranes, you see the Komatsus, you see work going on everywhere, all the way up past Baltimore Street. You have to see that huge site up there just in front of Hopkins on Broadway, and that's another massive site. So everywhere you look, you see this development. Which only makes me look at the old Fells Point, at the 18th and 19th century Fells Point, and makes that more precious to me, and I think more more valuable than ever before, because in this shining new development age, we are the original. We're the real thing. I mean, Williamsburg is a recreation. Those properties weren't there in the 18th century. Right. The Rockefellers studied and had them built there. But we still have the very streets when George Washington rode through here on his way back to Mount Vernon during the Rev War. We still have the same streets and the same street patterns. We have more properties surviving from the period of the War of 1812 than any other place in the state of Maryland, right here in Fells Point. Mm-hmm. So we will be surrounded by a lot of brand new, modern, and in most cases, extremely high-end mixed-use developments.
Cookie cutter developments sometimes, lots of times,
whatever the developers have needed to do to be able to do these projects is what the developers do, and that's simply to some extent I understand that better than most, because I've done a few individual properties myself, and I know what you run into along the way.
Yes.
And at Fells Point, you can run into anything. I mean anything, including mortal remains, because of the just how old we are. We ran into this big sort of underground cavern on one of our properties when we were doing archaeology.
Right.
And obviously if it's a reuse, you run into termites. We just have a marvelous history of termites in Fells Point. And we have our own peculiar kinds of wood rot here that seem to have been exacerbated by the recent line of hurricanes that we've had. So you keep thinking that you know exactly what's going on, and the technologies keep getting better for being able to identify what's going on. But at the end of the day, you have to cut the suit to fit the cloth, and that's what I found, particularly in working in these wooden houses.
Okay, yeah, the wooden houses are so important, and for our listeners' sake, there's quite a few of them. I mean, not quite a few, but enough that in around that we want to preserve them, and they are threatened because they're wooden, right? So
they're wooden on the well. We're referring specifically to the properties at 612, 614 South Wolf that were built about 1797.
So there's only two of them.
There's
more of them, aren't there?
There's a half one left, a couple of doors up.
Right, that's falling apart.
I think it's someone still living in it, but it's only half. The other half has been cut off.
Right.
I think if you can shut your eyes and imagine for a minute.
It looks good in the front, but in the back it doesn't look too good.
I haven't been in the back of the other one.
Yeah, I'll warn you. Actually, I'll work with you guys on that property a bit because I know some things about it. So.
Oh, okay. Well, that would be good.
But they're threatened. I mean, you know, two of them you fixed up. I mean, or well, they've been fixed up. Yeah.
No, I'm fixing those houses has been one of the greatest challenges of the Preservation Society's career, because, well, first, if you shut your eyes and look back, originally, we talked about how we had this huge supply of timber here and how it was so heavily wooded. Originally, Fells Point was wooden, because that was the natural supply that was here.
Sure, they were the original houses that everybody had. So
and they were, and except for the wealthy people, because we hadn't yet discovered our great deposits of clay that would later lead to Baltimore becoming a brick city. So the wealthy people, for the most part, had imported their brick, and wealthy people could afford brick.
Okay.
But when they were building Fells Point, click, 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 wood. And it was almost like a little Levitt town, where they would build these series of those houses or duplexes with little sally ports in between, one after the other, after the other, after the other. And actually, those houses and a number of other ones on the block were built by, going back to the Fell family again, they're so old, they were built by Anne Bond Fell Giles. Fell died.
Right.
She was an enterprising woman. Uh-huh. She was also the person who brought the concept of ground rent to Baltimore. It was most cities have now, people say, what's a ground rent?
Right, yeah, and that's a whole other story.
She brought ground rent here, and she knew she had this workforce. They needed housing.
Okay.
So those houses were built as speculation properties from the very beginning.
Yeah, so that goes on to one of our last subjects. Well, I mean, we could talk about this stuff all day long.
We could.
You know, and we were talking some things about Billie Holiday, who lived up the street, and how the neighbors are doing a screen painting type of effort. We were also talking about some of the challenges that we continue to face as a neighborhood in converting these old churches and these very historic, to us, very historic complexes like St. Stan's. And we were kind of talking about what was going on, and you know, how those properties, you know, we've managed to put an adaptive use on those properties. So I wanted to let our neighbors know across the globe that you can find adaptive uses for these old schools and missionaries and whatnot.
You can.
Yeah. But I want to bring you back for that stuff, because the thing is that, you know, I mean, we can keep talking about this, and you have the pulse on this stuff, you know, and it doesn't have to be everything that the Preservation Society is doing, but, you know, just kind of, if you could help us, if you enjoyed coming and talking to us about history, and, you know, I'd love to hear more about the gangs of the Baltimore. That could be a subject, you know. We were talking about some of the preservation efforts, actually, one time that, you know, that we were making in conjunction with preservation. So that's another subject.
We could talk about the fact that we're now the nexus of four National Historic Trails and a National Heritage Area. What other neighborhood in Baltimore City has that distinction? But that's a whole show. That's a whole other radio
program.
Right,
and we could, you know, but in essence, what we could do is take what we've done and show other folks, you know, look, this is a magic genie here that we've unbottled, and everybody's got a historic Main Street.
Yes.
You know, I want to, you know, take a minute and, you know, talk about your organization. What's the website? Your work is so critical. I mean, you're also doing an artifact exhibit down at the visitor center reading about.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Our website is in the process of being redeveloped at this moment. So at a later time, I'll give you our website. Our organization has been through a number of, I'll call them, really strategic shifts. Mm-hmm. We're going to be doing some new branding for ourselves, and so our mm-hmm. website just wasn't working anymore. But
you got a great domain and name, and the whole thing is that, you know what it shows you was at the preservationsociety.com,
yes.
Which means my God, these guys have been doing it, you know, since the beginning, you know.
We've been doing it. Well, we're second only, I always say, to Charleston, because Charleston, South Carolina, which has, you know, a marvelous historic preservation program, they got .org. So when we went to apply for our website, we had to settle for .com.
Right.
The Preservation Society, because we get their mail, sometimes they get ours. But the Preservation Society right now is basically engaged in three major initiatives. One of them is, quote, historic Fells Point. That's going to be, you're going to start to hear that all the time now.
Right.
And that has to do with our walking tours. It has to do with
Absolutely.
The visitor center, where we're going to have an orientation film. We're going to be doing a lot more theming on this topic of the shipbuilding and the privateer, since that was kind of the golden age of Fells Point. We're about to launch this major new six-month initiative that's going to really focus on the extraordinary African-American artist Romare Bearden, who spent a good deal of time in Baltimore, and Billie Holiday, our own Billie Holiday, who as a girl did live up on South Durham Street.
Right up the street here, right next door to Hedinger's.
Right up the street here. And that neighborhood association,
Butcher's
Upper
Hill?
Fells,
we're in Upper Fells Point.
But isn't that the Steve Schweiz organization, Upper Fells Point Improvement Association?
Yes, they are doing a great program.
They've received a grant. They are going to be doing these amazing murals. They're working on screen paintings, and of course it's very exciting because this is the 100th anniversary of, and screen painting is a folk art tradition specific to Baltimore and specific to Southeast Baltimore.
So important.
So we're weaving together.
Highland Town, they're doing a big thing with
the screen
painting.
They're doing a huge thing in Highland Town, and that was all over the East Baltimore Guide.
Yes.
They did a great story on it last week. But on the, I call it the Billy Black, on the Lady Day Way up there.
So important up there to give that area the recognition. It never has received it before.
It never has. And the other thing, I mean, we operate the visitor center. So we get these people in from Paris, and the French love Billie Holiday, and they're saying, well, où est la maison de Billie? You know, they're asking us, where is Billie Holiday's house? They know that she was here, and we're going, ooh.
It's embarrassing that there's nothing up there.
But now there will be.
She's such a great lady.
Thanks to the efforts of the Upper Fells Point Improvement Association.
Good for them.
They're doing an amazing job. And, of course, so we're going to sort of work with them to co-promote the program that that we're pulling together to honor Billy as well. So we're really, really excited about that. So we have Historic Fells Point. We have our heritage preservation efforts. That's the work that we actually do on these five buildings that we own.
Right.
We have an old bordello.
Do you?
We do.
What?
Captain's Hotel, purpose-built, 1629-31 Alisana. It was for officers. You know, you had places called the crimps, and that was where your ordinary mariner, you know, you guys came off the ship and you went in, and you know, you bed bugs and
no
STDs and
yes.
I mean, you know, this was not a
there's a good
there. That's a whole show too. We can talk about the social history of Fells Point at
there's
some
other
point.
There's a good tenement museum house in New York.
I've
been there, and it's the same type of thing. So,
but this place wasn't like that. This place was much more. It was for officers, and there were places of higher and lower repute. But that's a whole other show.
Yes, so the saucy stuff.
So that's our heritage preservation in terms of our buildings. Right now, all of our effort is focused on 612, 614 South Wolf Street, the little wooden houses.
Okay.
They were houses that in the 19th century that African-American caulkers actually lived in. And we've got some amazing new technologies. That's going to be an important part of our new website. But we are, you can't see it from the outside,
but
we're doing all kinds of stuff on the inside right now, and you'll soon see it on the outside. And then last but not least, we have the DeShiel Marine Collection, which to me is wonderful. It is
The Marine Collection?
Well, the family name. It's a Huguenot name, Marine. It doesn't mean the U.S. Marines. It means Marine of the Sea. It's an old Huguenot name. The Deschilles were a Huguenot family that married the Marines, who were a Huguenot family. And both of their families have this distinguished history in the state of Maryland. But Captain Henry Deschilles, he moved here. Captain Henry Deschilles, a young man, a handsome young man, moved here in at the end of the 18th century, and he meets the schoolmaster's daughter, Mary, a woman of singular loveliness. They fall in love. They get married. Off they go on this honeymoon. He takes her on the honeymoon voyage. We still have her log from that voyage. They begin collecting things. He's a privateer in the War of 1812. He can't get out of Fells Point when the Chesapeake is occupied, and before that when the embargo was on. So he's the last privateer vessel to sail out of Fells Point. He has children. One of his children gets married to they get married to all manner of people, but they have. So his grandson is a...
So you track all this stuff, all the generations.
Because it's all there in their letters. So you,
okay,
and then
so it's like the Tenement Museum up
it's
there.
It's like that, but it's one family's history. Then at the end, the old girls move back here, and they owned the bordello and the two wooden, and all the wooden houses. They went bankrupt, and that's how we acquired them. That's probably yet another show.
What a great story.
But we have this story that begins in 1797 and goes right through the 1980s from these two, from Mary Leake and Eleanor Marine Deschilles. So
there's other historical romances as well in Baltimore that we could probably spend 3 days talking about. You know, very swashbuckling or, you know, saucy, cool type of historical stuff. So, I mean, there's so many reasons to get you back, but there's so many reasons to get involved with your organization. So I would urge our listeners to visit Ellen and the good folks over at the Visitor Center, see how you could get involved with what they're doing to help with the restoration of these critical wooden houses and, you know, preserving these historical stories and environments. That is so important. And also, give us a shout over time to find out how you can help preserve your own historic Main Street. And I'm hoping, it sounds like you're going to be back here at the Baltimore Internet Radio. We want you back. I'm telling you that right now. There's any debate about that.
Thank you.
You know, we'll continue to spread the message of preservation and continue talking about history. So
that would be great. And just one other thing, too, to your listeners.
Okay. Sure.
History is not something where you have a name, you have a date, you have a place. There are those of you out there who know stories that I don't know. You know things that we don't know about Fells Point. You have information. You have photographs. You may have family members who have this. And especially those of you who have been here for a really long time. These are treasures. This is our heritage. We come to the Visitor Center and make an appointment for us to talk to you about these things, if you would, because I'm telling you, if you don't tell us, when you go, your story goes. And a neighborhood is a neighborhood lives on through the stories of its people and through the buildings that they lived in. So my last word there.
No, that's a great last word, but it's not the final word, because we're going to have you back on the stoop. And we're going to have you back here on the Baltimore Internet Radio. And, you know.
Thank you.
So it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. If you have a story, if you have photographs, if you have information, if you have artifacts that relate to any part of the history of Fells Point, we're really short on the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. You can contact me. You can come to the Fells Point Visitor Center at 1724 Thames Street. We're right there next to the Daily Grind. And come in there and we can make an appointment to talk. My email is simple. It's Ellen, E-L-L-E-N, at preservationsociety.com. Or the phone there is 410-675-6750. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Ellen, for that critical information. I wanted to thank you for coming today, and I urge our listeners to, one, tune in next week for another episode of On My Stoop with Ray. Thank you very much.